Okay, good morning everybody. I too would like to begin by acknowledging that we meet on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and acknowledge their elders past and present. It's terrific to see so many familiar faces out there today, some looking perhaps a little bit more worn and frayed from last year, but also terrific to see so many new faces. And I think that reflects the fact that the flexible learning framework has moved into a new era with the 2008 to 2011 strategy, which is about embedding e-learning in enterprise and organisations. So terrific to see you all here today. I hope that you use the next 2 days to build relationships and networks with many people, and also to take advantage of the many events that will be running over the next 2 days. Given that we live in an incredibly and increasingly connected world, it's terrific that we get this opportunity to come together over the next 2 days as an e-learning community. During today, I think you're going to see 38 presentations from the New South Wales innovation projects this year, which will be terrific to share in their experiences and hopefully take ideas away that you may be able to apply in your own circumstances. We also have some outstanding leaders in the e-learning field speaking to us today and over the next 2 days, in fact. And I'd like to begin by welcoming Mark Pesci as our keynote speaker. It was my experience, I guess, a few weeks back to speak after Mark, and he left the audience breathless, so I'm glad that I've gotten up first today. So for those of you that don't know Mark, and I'm sure most of you do, Mark is a writer, an inventor, an educator and a futurist, and is somewhat known for his appearances on the ABC New Inventors panel. And I'm sure he'll have some very stimulating comments for us today and will give us much to consider over the next 2 days and into the future. So I'd like to ask you to give a warm welcome to Mark Pesci.
Good morning, everybody. Bright, shiny faces. Okay, can we go to the next slide, please? We're going to talk about control, but I need to start off with a little bit of a movie. Next slide, please, and let's make sure the sound's up.
Okay, so now the computer will show a command bar. Okay, and we type in X equals Y plus 1. Okay, and then it says we hit Command Y to bring up the menu screen.
Oh, man, you've got to be kidding me. Goddamn jabs are everywhere.
Okay, now right-click on menu item Equate O and tap in Input Y.
Oh, dude, are you on America's side, Stan?
No, I'm on the Japanese side.
Who just shot me?
Okay, let's see. The right-click is the upper right... but then what the hell is this? Okay, kids, I'm going to need to get some clarification on this. Just keep entering the calculations. I'll be right back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dude, I wish I had a real flamethrower. It works awesome on jabs.
So our greatest fear when we bring computers into the classroom is that the teachers and the instructors will lose control of the classroom. They'll lose touch with the students. They'll lose their ability to make a difference. The computer is ultimately a disruptive device. It offers greater authority than the instructor, offers greater resources than any lecturer, and it offers greater reach than any teacher. The computer is not perfect, but it is indefatigable. It's not omniscient, but it's comprehensive. It's not instantaneous, but it's faster than any other tool we've ever used. And all of this puts us human beings at a disadvantage. In a classroom full of machines, the human factor in education is bound to be overlooked, even though we know that everyone learns much more effectively when there's a teacher or a mentor present. We want to believe that everything can be done with the computer. We want the machine to distract, and we hope that in that distraction some education is going to happen. But distraction is simply not enough. There must be a point to the exercise. There must be some reason that makes all of the technology worthwhile. And that search for a point, a search that we're mostly still engaged in, will determine whether these computers are meaningful to the educational process, if they're an impediment to learning. And it's all about control. What's most interesting about the computer is how it puts paid to all of our cherished fantasies about control. The computer, or really more specifically the global internet that's connected to it, is ultimately disruptive, not just to the classroom learning experience, but to the entire rationale of the classroom, of school, of the institution of learning. And if you believe this to be hyperbolic, I want to start with a little story. Next slide, please. Now, in May of 1999, Silicon Valley software engineer John Swapshinsky started a website known as, next slide please, Teacher Ratings. Individuals could visit the site and fill out a brief form with details about their school and about their teacher. And once they'd done that, they could rate the teacher's capabilities as an instructor. Now, the site started out slowly in 1999. This is always the case with these sorts of, next slide please, crowdsourced ventures. But as more ratings were added to the site, next slide please, it became more useful to people, which meant more visitors, which meant more ratings, which means it became even more useful, which meant more visitors, which meant more ratings. And somewhere in the middle of this virtuous cycle of growth, the site changed its name to RateMyProfessors.com. It's changed ownership twice since 1999, and for the last 2 years, RateMyProfessors.com has been owned by MTV, all right, which knows a thing or two about youth markets and can see one in a site that has 9 million ratings of 1 million teachers, professors, and instructors in the U.S. and Canada. Now, next slide, please. Although the individual action of sharing some information about an instructor seems innocuous enough, in aggregate, the effect is entirely revolutionary. A student about to attend a university in the United States can check out all of her potential instructors before she signs up for a class. She can choose to only take those classes with instructors who have received the best ratings, or, rather more perversely, only with instructors who are known to be easy graders. The student is now wholly in control of her educational opportunities, going in eyes wide open, fully cognizant of what to expect on her first day of class. Now, although RateMyProfessors.com has enlightened students, it has made the work of educational administrators exponentially more difficult. Students now talk up and down the years via the recorded ratings on the site. It isn't possible for an institution of higher education to disguise an individual who happens to be a world-class researcher, but a rather ordinary lecturer. In earlier times, schools would foist these instructors on students who'd be stuck for an entire semester. This no longer happens because RateMyProfessors.com effectively warns students away from the poor quality teachers. Next slide, please. Oops, let's go back. There, okay. So this one site has undone all of the neat work of the tenure boards and department chairs throughout the entire world of academia. A bad lecturer is no longer a department's little secret, but it's publicly available information. A great lecturer is no longer a carefully hoarded treasure, but a hot commodity on a very public market. The instructors with the highest ratings on RateMyProfessors.com find themselves in demand, receiving outstanding offers with tenure from other universities. All of this plotting, which used to be hidden from view, is now fully revealed. The battle for control over who stands in front of the classroom has now been decisively lost by the administrators in favor of the students. And this is not something that anyone had expected. It certainly wasn't what John Swapshinsky had in mind when he founded Teacher Ratings. He wasn't trying to overturn the prerogatives of school heads around the world. He was simply looking for a place for people to pool their knowledge. But that knowledge, once pooled, takes on a life of its own, and it finds itself in places that its makers never intended. Now, this rating system serves as an archetype for what is about to happen to education in general. If we are smart enough, we can learn a lesson here now that we will eventually learn rather more expensively if we wait. The lesson is simple. Control is over. This is not about control anymore. This is about finding a way to thrive in the chaos. And the chaos is not something we should be afraid of. Like King Canute, we cannot roll back the tide that's rolling over us. We can't roll back the clock to an earlier age without computers or without internet and without the subtle but profound distraction of text messaging. The school is of its time, not out of it, which means we've got to play the hand we're dealt. That's actually a good thing because we hold a lot of powerful cards, or can, if we choose to face the chaos head on. Now, in my closing, I'll cover the strategies to deal with chaos. But for the next little bit, I want to talk about what kind of educational institutions we'll see in the 21st century. In some ways, they'll be quite different from the ones we're familiar with today. Next slide, please. Now, if we take the example of RateMyProfessors.com and push it out just a little bit, we can see the shape of things to come. But there are some other trends which are becoming visible. The first and most significant of these is the trend towards sharing lecture material online so that it reaches a very large audience. Next slide, please. Spearheaded by Stanford University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the United States, both of which have placed their entire set of lectures online through iTunes University, these educational institutions assert that the lectures themselves aren't the reasons that students spend $50,000 a year to attend these schools. The lectures only have full value in context. Next slide, please. And this is true, in a sense, but it discounts the possibility that an individual or group of individuals might create their own context around the lectures. And this seems to be where the future is pointing. Next slide, please. When broken down into its atomic components, the classroom is an agreement between an instructor and a set of students. The instructor agrees to offer expertise and mentorship, while the students offer attention and dedication. The question now becomes, what role, if any, does the educational institution play in coordinating these components? Students can share their ratings online. Why wouldn't they also share their educational goals? And once they've pooled their goals, what keeps them from recruiting their own instructor, booking their own classroom, indeed, just doing it themselves? At the moment, the educational institution has an advantage over the singular student in that it already exists to coordinate the various functions of education. A student doesn't have access to the same facilities or the same coordination tools, but we already see that this is changing. RateMyProfessors.com points the way. Why not create a new kind of open university, a website that offers nothing but the scheduling and coordination tools that students might need to organize their own courses? I'm sure that if this hasn't already been invented, someone is currently working on it. It's a natural outgrowth of all the efforts towards student empowerment we've seen in the last few years. Next slide, please. In this near future world, students are the administrators. All of the administrative functions have been pushed down into a substrate of software. Education has evolved into something like a marketplace where instructors bid to work with students. Now, since most education is funded by the government, there will obviously be other forces at play. It may be that administration, such as it is in the 21st century, represents the government oversight function, which ensures that standards are being met. In any case, this does not look much like the educational institution of the 20th century, though it does look an awful lot like the university of the 13th century, where students would find and hire instructors to teach them subjects. Next slide, please. The role of the instructor has changed as well. As recently as a few years ago, the lecturer was the font of wisdom and the source of all knowledge, and perhaps with a companion textbook. In the age of Wikipedia and YouTube and Twitter, this is no longer the case. A lecturer now helps the students to find the material online, helps them to make sense of it, contextualizing and informing their understanding, even as the students continue to work their way through an ever-growing set of information. The instructor cannot know everything that is available online on any subject, but will be aware of perhaps his favorite and best resources, and will pass those resources on as a key outcome of the educational process. The instructor facilitates and mentors, as they have always done, but they are no longer gatekeepers to knowledge, because there are no gatekeepers anywhere. Next slide, please. The administration is gone. The instructor's role has evolved. Now, what happens to the classroom itself? In the context of a larger school facility, it may or may not be relevant. A classroom is clearly relevant if someone's learning engine repair, for example, but it may not be relevant if someone is learning calculus. The classroom in this fluid future of student administrators and evolved lecturers is the place where learning happens. If that can happen entirely online, that will be the classroom. If it requires substantial darshan, presence with the instructor, then it will have a physical locale, which may or may not be inside of a building dedicated to education. At one end of the scale, students will be able to work with each other and a lecturer to master material online. At the other end, students will work closely with a mentor in a specific classroom. The entire range of possibilities can be accommodated without much of the infrastructure we currently associate with education. The classroom will implode, vanishing online, and explode where the world becomes the classroom. Next slide, please. So this, then, can be predicted from current trends. Once RateMyProfessors.com succeeded in destabilizing the institutional hierarchies in education, everything else became inevitable. It'll take some time, but it's inevitable. Because this transformation lies mostly in the future, it is possible to shape each of these trends with actions taken in this present. In the worst-case scenario, our educational institutions do not adjust to the pressures placed upon them by this new generation of students and are simply swept aside as these students rise into self-empowerment as the students learn to do it for themselves. But the worst case need not be the only case. There are concrete steps which institutions can take to ease the transition from the highly formal present in education into our wildly informal and fluid future. In order to roll with the punches delivered by these newly empowered students, educational institutions must become more fluid, more open, more atomic, and less interested in hallowed traditions than in outcomes. Next slide, please. Thank you so much. Now, flexibility and fluidity are the hallmarks of 21st century educational institutions. Translating flexibility into activity comes as a result of an analysis which takes a look at the classroom and what goes on there. In this context, the class or classroom is a series of readings and assignments and lectures that happen in a given room over a given duration of time. In our drive to flexibility and fluidity, can we reduce this class to essential indivisible elements? Can we capture these elements? Once captured, can we deliver these elements to students? And how can these students share elements which they found in their own studies? So, my recommendations. Next slide, please. Recommendation one, capture everything. Let me ask, am I being captured today? Will I be podcast later on? God bless you, sir. All right. I am consistently amazed. I give a lot of talks. I'm consistently amazed. I think, in fact, the last time I gave a talk where I was being recorded, the same person was recording me. I'm constantly amazed that we do not record absolutely everything that happens in public fora as a matter of course. This talk is being recorded. And it's not, next slide, please. It's not that my words are particularly worthy of preservation. but it's because this should be standard operating procedure for education at all levels in all subject areas. It makes no sense to waste my words, to literally pour them out on the ground. With very little infrastructure, you can make an audio recording, and with just a tiny bit more infrastructure, you can make a video recording. Next slide, please. This is the basic idea that's guiding Stanford and MIT and Uni Melbourne and Uni New South Wales. Recording is cheap, lecturers are expensive, and students are forgetful. Somewhere in the middle of these three trends, they all meet around the idea of recorded media. Yes, a student at Stanford who misses a lecture can download it and watch it later, and that's a good thing, or even better, the instructor can record the lecture ahead of time, and then when class time comes, the students can simply sit and ask the lecturer questions. They can get a lot more out of this because the basic work of the lecture has been done ahead of time. It also means that any student anywhere can download the same lecture. Now, yes, recording everything means that you end up with a wealth of media that must be tracked, it must be stored, it must be archived, it must be referenced, so on and so on. That's actually all to the good, because every one of these recordings has value. And the more recordings you have, the larger the hoard you're sitting on. If you think of it like that, banking your work, the logic of capturing everything becomes immediately clear. Next slide, please. Recommendation 2, share everything. Now, while education definitely has value and teachers are paid for their work, it does not mean that resources, once captured, should be very tightly restricted to authorized users only. In fact, the opposite is the case. The resources you capture should be shared as broadly as can be managed. Next slide, please. And that's more than just putting them on your website or on YouTube or iTunes. You need to trumpet the existence of these resources from the highest tower. These resources are your calling card. If someone comes across one of your lectures or other resources and is favorably impressed by it, doesn't that mean that they're more likely to attend a class? Now, the center of this argument is simple, but it's subtle. The more something is shared, the more valuable it becomes. You extend your brand with every resource you share. You extend the reach of your institution throughout the internet. Whatever you have, if it's good enough, will bring people to your front door, either virtually or physically. Next slide, please. If university is as illustrious and expensive as Stanford and MIT and UNSW can share their full courseware online without worrying that it would dilute the education that they offer, how can any other institution hope to refute that example? Both universities voted with their feet, and both show a different way to value education. They're saying the value of education isn't in the lecture. The value of education is in the experience of attending school here. You can't download an experience. You can't bottle an experience. Experience has to be lived, and that requires a teacher. Next slide, please. Now, you will be, and you probably already are, being approached by vendors promising all sorts of wonderful things for the educational process to make it seamless and nearly magical for the educators and the students. Don't believe a word of it. I will tell you this. If I had a dollar for every gripe I've heard from an educator about Blackboard or WebCT, I would be a very rich man. There is no off-the-shelf tool that is perfectly equipped for every situation. Each tool tries to shoehorn an infinity of possibilities into a limited palette. Next slide. Rather than going for a commercial solution, I would advise you to look at the open-source solutions. Rather than buying a solution, use Moodle, the open-source Australian answer to digital courseware. Going open means that as your needs change, software can change to meet those needs. Given the extraordinary pressures that education will be under in the next few years, openness is a necessary component of flexibility. Next slide. Openness is also about achieving a certain level of device independence. Education happens everywhere, not just with your nose down in a book or stuck into a computer screen. There are many screens today, and while the laptop screen may be the most familiar to educators, The handset has a screen which is in many ways more vital. Many students will never be computer literate, but every single one of them has a mobile handset and every single one of them sends text messages. It's a big part of the computer technology that we always overlook because it's so commonplace. Every screen, consider every screen when you capture and when you share. How will this look on this screen? How will it look on this device? Dealing with them all as equals will help your work find audiences that you never knew you'd have. Next slide, please. And there's a third aspect to openness, open networks. Educators of every stripe throughout Australia are under enormous pressure to clean the network feeds available to students. This is as true for adult students as it is for educators who have a duty of care responsibility to their younger students. Age makes no difference, apparently. The web is big, it's bad, it's evil, and it must be tamed. Yet, net filtering throws the baby out with the bathwater. Services like Twitter, for example, get filtered out because they can be potentially disruptive, cutting students off from the amazing potential of social messaging. Facebook and MySpace are seen as time wasters rather than tools for organizing busy schedules. The list goes on. Media sites get blocked because schools don't have enough bandwidth to support them. Wikipedia is blocked because teachers don't want students cheating. All of this has got to stop. The classroom does not exist in isolation, and it cannot continue to exist in opposition to the internet. Filtering, while providing a stopgap, only leaves students painfully aware of how disconnected the classroom is from the real world. Filtering makes the classroom less flexible and less responsive. Filtering is lazy. Next slide, please. Recommendation number four, only connect. The maxim of the 21st century is this, connection is king. Students must be free to connect with instructors almost at a whim. This becomes difficult for instructors to manage, but it's vital. Mentorship has exploded out of the classroom, and through connectivity it has entered everyday life. Students should also be able to freely connect with educational establishments. A fruitful relationship between the student and the educational administrator will keep students actively engaged in the mechanics of their education. Next slide, please. Finally, students must be free and freely encouraged to connect with their peers. Part of the reason that we worry about lecturers being overburdened by all of this connectivity is that we've yet to realize this is a multi-way affair. It's not as though all of the questions need to immediately rise to the instructor's attention. This should happen if and only if another student can't answer the question. Students should instruct one another. They should mentor one another. They should teach one another. All of this already happens in every classroom. It's long past time to provide tools to accelerate this natural and effective form of education. Again, look to ratemyprofessors.com. It shows the value of crowdsourced learning. Now, connection is expensive, not in dollars, but in time. But for all its drawbacks, it enriches us enormously. It allows us to multiply our reach. It allows us to learn from the best. The challenge of connectivity is nowhere near as daunting as the capability it delivers. Yet we know that everyone is going to be looking to maintain control and stability as everything everywhere gets progressively reshaped by all of this connectivity. We need to let go. We need to trust ourselves enough to recognize that what we have now, though it worked for a while, is no longer fit for the times. If we can do that, we can make this transition seamless and pleasant. We must embrace sharing and openness and connectivity. In these, we have the fluidity we need for the future. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mark. We have some time for questions, and I think Melanie over on that side there and Paula on this side here have roving mics. So if you have a question, please feel free to wave your arm around, but please wait until the mic is with you because this is being recorded and we need the mic there to do so. Has anyone got a question of Mark? or a comment, of course. You're a passive lot, aren't
you? Yeah, it's always hard to get the first question out of the crowd. Generally, you have a plan. I think there. The best thing is generally you have a plan for the first question.
Just on your comment about open everything, and you were saying that the need to things like Wikipedia shouldn't be blocked for students to use. Don't you think it encourages laziness, or can encourage laziness among students, where you can literally just go to Wikipedia, cut and paste what you need, paste it into your document, perhaps change it a little bit so you're not plagiarising what it is, but you're not looking at a variety of sources, you're just going to the instant one?
I think it should be made clear to the students that that's not an effective way for them to learn. The degree to which you want to run a plagiarism filter against student submissions is something else. I mean, you can always dangle that in front of them, that if we see you plagiarizing from Wikipedia, then we're going to hit you for it. But that none of those are sufficient reasons to block Wikipedia. That's the thing. You know, so it's sort of like saying, we're so afraid that you're going to plagiarize that we're going to completely block Wikipedia, versus we don't want you to plagiarize. It's not an effective way to learn. It will defeat your goals as a learner. So, yes, Wikipedia is there, but don't plagiarize from it. You know, I mean, one of these is a moderate and nuanced point of view. The other one is extreme. And what's being lost there in extremity is that it may be that in order to understand a subject better, they need to do a whole bunch of background research, which Wikipedia can easily provide for them, to be able to give them a sense. Because Wikipedia is not particularly good for depth material, but it's quite good for giving you an overview of something. And it may be that the core thing, no, they should be doing the research there, but if it's attaching, the good thing about Wikipedia is if something strikes your, well, wait, what about that? You just type it in, and you can then get this penumbra of other material that's coming in. And if you block Wikipedia, that penumbra just can't happen.
Warren Wilson from MindSkill Australia. I'm probably relatively unique in a room overwhelmingly populated by TAFE teachers and institutional representatives. But I'd like to ask you how you see the economic framework of the system you propose developing.
This is a good question. Education in Australia, but also globally, is a mixed private and public system. And so, I mean, in a public system, dollars get spent for a certain number of bodies on seats, basically. And if there are different ways of achieving that goal that are flexibly organized, if there are different ways of achieving that goal that are flexibly organized, then I think that you're going to see the formation of, it's a different kind, what I called a new kind of open university, so that people will be able to get together in a flexibly organized unit. Now, the degree to which they need any sort of central administration, that's something that the central administration may look a lot more like eBay than like the vice chancellor's office at UNSW. All right. There's a central administration at eBay. There's dispute resolutions. All of it compared to the amount of sale that's going on eBay as an entire time is very small. So it may simply be that we're seeing something that's closer to that. Now, the question is how the public-private mix works in there, and whether someone who's offering these services through a public financing mechanism is going to have to offer a certain due diligence to the public or organizations, in which case you're then going to see, again, probably private for-profit organizations stepping in to be the interlocutors in there.
I'd like to make a comment about the Wikipedia. I actually think, in a way, you know, a student could pick up a book and plagiarise it. If it's on Wikipedia, you'll be able to check it far more easier than perhaps a book to track it down. And I think there's a lot. Wikipedia is a fantastic thing. Maybe you can encourage your students to contribute to Wikipedia and actually build the content of what they discover and add to. I think it'd be dreadful to block it. The more we share, the more value there is, as you said in your presentation.
And I'm hoping that we're starting to see Wikipedia work its way into curricula. But it seems to me that the easiest way to sort of prevent plagiarism is to assign the students to have to add a paragraph to an article that's already in Wikipedia, right? Because then you have to have complete master material plus turn up something that's not on there and get it past the Wikipedia editors. You know, so that there's different ways of working with that don't necessarily involve it as a plagiarism. You're right.
Hello, Mark. Colin Alcock from Riverina Institute. Thank you for your talk. I found it really stimulating. I'm wondering if we have results of the implications for enrolments for Stanford and MIT following their putting all the material online.
Yeah, they haven't changed at all. As far as I know, they're still incredibly oversubscribed. I mean, they always are. Both of those schools tends to be something like 10-1 oversubscribed for enrollments. And nothing's changed there. The interesting thing is, I was talking to one of my good friends who works in Apple Education, and he and I were having coffee yesterday. And he said he was talking to someone who was talking to the folks at Stanford, and really questioned this idea of putting all the lectures up online. And he turned to him and said, "Look, when I now post the lectures up ahead of class, and then the students come in, and rather than me just lecturing the material, they get an hour to ask any questions they have. Where do you think they're getting the value?" All right. So in fact, recording the lectures has freed the instructors up. It hasn't just freed the students up. It's freed the instructors up to really focus on meeting student needs. So if that's the case, as that gets known, that's probably only going to increase the desire for students to go there.
Yes. In terms of the filtering, does this filtering of websites, does this mean that in terms of our teaching we need to think about things like digital citizenship, where we teach students actually how to assess sites and do things like that, not only so that when they go out in the bad, cruel world outside of their institutions, that they understand what's being asked of them or what's the dangers on the web, but also they can assess the information for themselves, and also in terms of understanding that digital fluency, getting a digital fluency so they can communicate to those. There's a real content need there, I think, in terms of our teaching, not to just sort of open the floodgates, but to give some value added to that opening of the floodgates.
Amen. Yeah, that's pretty much where I want to go with that. It's interesting talking. I did a tour with Acer earlier this year, and I talked to a lot of primary and secondary educators. And the thing that was quite clear from talking to them is that giving, say, a year 7 student a laptop is roughly the equivalent of giving them a loaded gun. And that unless we're going to teach them gun safety, digital citizenship, and I think is a very sort of succinct way of putting it, then the outcomes will, well, people are going to get shot, and people are going to get hurt, and people are going to shoot themselves, and they're going to shoot other people. And I guess the question is, right now we're relying on kids picking up these skills on the street. You know, and there's a problem there. And the problem isn't, the interesting thing is the problem isn't just in the schools, because the computers are in the homes too. And in fact, it's up to the parents to do this, as well as the student, as well as the educators. It's not local to one thing. It's a cross-cultural thing. So yes, amen. But we need to think of it comprehensively. It's not just something that happens in an hour in a classroom.
Thanks very much, Mark. My name is Michael Kimber from Health Star Training Network. A question then for learning institutions, and that is, how is the assessment going to be in the future? Because a lot of the universities and TAFEs have this attitude that, for instance, if you're doing a statistics course, when you go in to do an examination, you have to use a calculator because you can't get onto the computer because you could find everything on the computer.
Right.
So how are they going to adapt to the new age?
Yeah. This is a very good question. Our assessment methods are not well suited to our learning methods now. There's a bit of a disconnect between them. And we're seeing that. We're using assessment methods that are derived from pen and paper modes of instruction. And we're not in a pen and paper age anymore. The ultimate assessment mechanism is interaction with a mentor, with the, or instructor or learner, in that they're the person who can tell you know, did you just answer that question correctly, or did you just go online and look up the formulas and all of this stuff? And so, in a sense, assessment becomes much more human-intensive, labor-intensive and human-intensive, and that sort of, in some sense, balances the fact that the instructing is becoming more richly laden with things that are coming in from a whole bunch of different dimensions. And that may be the way the trade-off's working in the future.
One more, just the last one.
Hello, hello, Simon Gray from Ultimo TAFE. I just point out that TAFEs are behind the debt filtering, which is a real problem.
I know.
I was hoping you were aware of that.
Yeah. No, Twitter is blocked.
Yes.
Right, and it's just when I heard that, my heart broke.
Yes, and secondly, you pointed out that you can't download the. In the experience of learning in an environment. Right. I think blended learning I can see working really well with a lot of the tools that are here. But what about purely online learning? That must be a big factor for the success or otherwise of online learning. I guess that's about the extent of the question that I've got. Yeah. Is what is the future for online learning without that?
Yeah,
experience.
I still think that the online learning experience is going to be rich. There's going to be tools that give you presence. I think whether that's going to be video conferencing with Skype or online chat tools or whatever they're going to be, they're going to be tools that give you presence. And we're going to, I think one of the mistakes would be to assume that everything works well online, or because I see that as being an edge case where certain types of education work well online. For instance, if I were taking a class in Chinese, as long as I had a lot of time to maybe Skype someone in China and talk to them in conjunction with material that I was doing online, that actually might work out well. It's hard to know. I couldn't know in advance whether, you know, and again, maths, you know, these are the two examples that Kevin Rudd used when he was talking about getting the laptops in school, language drilling in maths. I'm not sure about everything else, about where that comes in. I don't think we have the answers here yet. We don't have, okay, look at this is the format for this particular thing. I think these things are going to evolve, but they're going to evolve across that continuum between completely embodied and completely disembodied.
Okay, I'm sorry, I know that there are more questions, but the time is rolling on, and we're going to have a break in a minute, so I'm sure Mark will stay around for you to come and have a chat for a few minutes in between sessions. But first of all, please join with me in thanking Mark Pesce for his keynote today.